to order of the Joint Ways and Means Committee for Subcommittee on Education. And today, pardon me, we have two presentations, Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. We have an overview scheduled for approximately 40 minutes. And then the Oregon Health and Science University overview, about 30 minutes. And we understand that this very short, compact time, and we appreciate your efforts in staying within the time. And the committee members have agreed, and they've been wonderful in the past, waiting to ask questions until the end of the presentation. And with that, I would like to call up Cam Preuss-Brawley, the Commissioner of the Community Colleges Services, to give us the overview of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And Ms. Preuss-Brawley, I know there are several community college presidents who are joining us, and that's very encouraging to all of us here. And if you would, perhaps, and they wouldn't be embarrassed, if you'd introduce them so we can recognize our community college presidents.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm very happy to have them introduce themselves, as they're all staring at the back of my head. We start with Judith, please.
Judith Hanson, Southwestern Oregon Community College.
Well, I'm Nissen, and I'm Park Community College.
Jim Middleton, Central Oregon Community College.
Jeff Sorensen, Treasure Valley Community College.
Trent Smith, Klamath Community College.
Frank Soda, Lovely Doors Community College.
Peter Anstead, Rowe Community College.
Pam Coffey, one of the campus presidents from Portland Community College.
Joanne Truesdell from Clackamas Community College.
Mary Spilty Wayne Community College.
John Turner, Blue Mountain Community College.
Gretchen Schutte, Schmeichler Community College.
And Bob Soron, that
thank you all very much. Appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I feel very supported, and I'm certain that they'll hang on my every word and remind me of those that I've taken in error. Today is an overview of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and I wanted to give you a little background about community colleges before we started. They were formed in the 1959 Legislative Assembly, and in 1961 and 62 there were less than 20,000 students enrolled, about 19,444. 45 years later, there are 17 community colleges, and there are 357,511 students enrolled in the 17 community colleges. They provide an array of programs which include strengthening academic knowledge and skills, preparing students to enter and advance in the workplace, to complete their basic literacy and other education needs, to complete their undergraduate coursework so they can move forward in a bachelor's, and of course a major thrust of Oregon's community colleges applied employers with specialized training for their employees. Our peak enrollment in community colleges was in 2001-02. It was also our peak funding time, and we served that year 406,000 students. In the workforce development programs, most of these are federally funded. They provide supports for adults and youth to keep and progress in their jobs. The department is primarily an administrative entity. We don't provide any programs directly other than the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. So we are what's euphemistically called a pass-through agency. And if you turn to page 2 of the briefing that has been provided, we have captured for you on this slide the department's mission. Because we don't deliver programs, we believe we contribute leadership and resources to increase the skill, knowledge, and career opportunities for Oregonians. And we do that through the 17 community colleges. There are 19 adult basic education programs in the state. There are 36 Oregon Youth Conservation county-based programs, 7 workforce investment areas that receive the federal workforce development dollars, and 15 workforce regions. Moving on to slide number 3, the department has 3 boards that it is primarily responsible to that provide us with policy priorities and some governance structure. Slide number 3 has a graphic of that includes the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which has provides guidance for the federal workforce training dollars that come to the department. The State Board of Education, which has oversight authority over the community colleges as well as K-12. And then there is the Joint Boards of Education, which is that amalgamation of the State Board of Higher Education and the State Board of Education, and they come together around issues of articulation, alignment, and most recently, data and budget. I wanted to bring your attention to the box at the bottom of this particular slide, which is the Education Enterprise Target. And it will be familiar to some of you who have participated in the interim. I was speaking with the governor's education advisor, James Sager, at the business summit when we received the business plan packet that had the almost identical target of 20% of Oregonians with nothing less than a high school diploma, 40% of Oregonians with professional certification or associates, and 40% with a bachelor's degree. I think it is important that even though we were working along separate, they were very parallel processes to come to the same target, the Oregonians need to be better educated and better prepared for the future. All 3 of these boards concentrate on that highly skilled workforce, although we go about it in different ways. And it is so that Oregonians can be successful. And in order to be successful, they must have the skills to compete globally. Slide 4 is a quote that came from a report that was done about 2 years ago, but it remains true. Our competitiveness is going to absolutely depend on the knowledge and skill of the workforce. Community colleges and workforce development are key partners in the development of this 21st century workforce. Slide 5 then gives you a picture. Likely you have seen this before, but I always think it helps to have a reminder that education does matter, and it matters because the more learning you have, the more earning power you have. Also, in this particular graph, it shows you, there's superimposed on it, is the unemployment rate. And you will notice it's inversely proportional. So the lower your education, the higher your expected unemployment rate. Yet another reason to invest our energy and our resources in education. The average earnings of a community college student that has an associate's degree is over $40,000 a year. And that's 117% more than someone without a high school diploma. And it's about 40% higher than a student with a diploma or a GED. Slide number 6 is another example of giving another cut at those wages and those jobs. And this slide shows you where the jobs are going to, where the growth in jobs will be, and what the minimum education requirements will be. Increasingly, the jobs that require higher knowledge are outpacing the the low knowledge and low skill jobs, and not inconsequently, they are also the low wage jobs. Nearly 80% of the jobs in the low wage occupations, those that pay less than $30,000 a year, require nothing more than on the job training. At the other extreme, close to 2/3 of all jobs in high wage occupations, those that pay over $45,000 a year, require at least a bachelor's degree. Clearly, to obtain a job in a high wage occupation, it pays to have a higher level of education. So now I would like to talk with you more specifically about community colleges and their role in the education matters equation. Slide number 7 is a compilation of mission statements from the 17 colleges, most of which are sitting behind me. What I hope to bring to you in this slide is the expanse of their missions. I think most of you know your community college. You may even know what their mission statement is. But it is always comprehensive. That's what's in the statute, that Oregon's community colleges will offer a wide variety of programming to meet the community needs. Key words that I picked up from the consistent messages in these missions are quality learning experiences, community responsiveness, and individual growth and success. I earlier talked about the organizational structure of how the department fits in inside state government and with other boards. Slide number 8 is a picture of the community college governance, showing how community colleges at the local level interact with two state level entities. Most of you know that the local community college has a locally elected board. The presidents are hired by that board and serve at their pleasure. And there are, we have 17 campuses and many satellite and other affiliate sites across the state. Then in this particular slide on the far right side is the Oregon Community College Association Board. That board is made up of the president and one board member from each of those 17 local boards. Andrea Henderson, who is in the audience, didn't get to introduce herself because she's not a president. I'm sure you all know her. She could raise her hand. She is the person who has the dubious honor of directing a board of 34 members. And then her staff. We have already talked about that middle section, which is the department and its reporting authorities.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Becker.
Sorry to interrupt, Cam. I don't know if we're interrupting as she goes or...
Well, go ahead.
I just said. So.
We're going to try to do questions at the end, but
I'm off scripts. Cam, you've seen this. So, Cam, what do you do, and what does Andrea do? What is your mission, and then what is Andrea's mission? How do they differ?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, our roles are different. Our missions are the same. The role of CCWD and the commissioner is to work with the state board to provide oversight and guidance and, oh, by the way, program approval and audits and data collection for the 17 community colleges. We actually are the entity that builds the budget, that requests the budget. Andrea's role is one of advocacy as well as policy identification and conversation with the stakeholders at the local level. And I think it's fair to say that we tend to be joined at the hip. The department and the board have ongoing meetings with the executive committee of the OCCA as we go about building the budget and what the budget request will be. And we have a common set of values and guiding principles about what we're after in that budget. And it's a friendly negotiation to get to a place where I will present to the board a number that they are comfortable with, as well as the OCCA board is comfortable with.
So, Mr. Chair, are there other states that arrange similarly? Is there one other state that has a similar type of arrangement where you have a private board or a semi?
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, yes, there are, and there are also examples where there is only one entity, and public affairs and advocacy is part of the department, similar to the university system, and that's usually where it's a system. There are others. Arizona, about 7 years ago, actually defunded their state agency and only have an association now. So it runs the gamut. If you'd like more specific, I can bring that back. So I'm on slide 9, and this is a picture of the college, the Oregon Community Colleges, the 17 colleges and their satellite campuses. There are a multitude of satellite campuses, and they have they're also providing community college services at high schools, ESDs, libraries, lots of access points. They range in size from Portland Community College, where they serve 88,000 students a year, to Tillamook Bay, which serves about 2,300 students a year. Slide number 10 is a quick look at the community college programming. There should be, these should be familiar to you. Community colleges partner with their educational educational partners, high schools, the university system, also private universities, business and industry within their communities, and their workforce partners, that would be the Employment Department and the Department of Human Services, as well as Economic Development. Very quickly, to be successful with lower division transfer, colleges not only offer classes, but they have co-enrollment. And that's where students are enrolled in both community colleges and the university system. Dual enrollment, and that's where community colleges reach down and assist high school students who are ready to take credit-bearing courses. We have listed there also the Oregon Transfer Module. That may be new language for many of you. We worked with the university system in the interim to build a one-year certificate that had 45 credits of general education, and it is accepted at all 24 public institutions. And so it's a block of courses that move, so students, when they have it, they know they know that what they have earned in the college that they are moving to is ready to accept it. We also have associate degrees, and we have about 92,000 students who are enrolled in lower division courses. Professional technical courses are the trades, nursing, automotive, those kinds of degrees and certificates. There are also college credit now courses there, so that students that are in high school can also earn professional technical credit. There's a lot of industry training and certification. Another large piece of community colleges is adult basic education. This is the education that prepares students to take collegiate level work. There is about half of the students that are enrolled in adult basic education are there for as English language learners. And certainly last but not least is business and industry connection with workforce skill enhancement and the small business development centers. Slide number 11 is a look at the proportion of students that are enrolled in these different program areas. Lower division is 44%. If we were to take a snapshot backwards, that number is trending up. the most dramatic, or the professional technical programs have declined some over the last 5 years. I would say that what you're looking at is not an enrollment picture per se, but there is, in that historical upward trend of community college enrollment that I mentioned at the beginning, 406,000, we have seen a dramatic drop of over 14% in 2002-03, and we have not yet rebounded to our previous enrollment levels. We currently have 86,611 full-time reimbursable students. The total FTE have decreased about 10% from a high of 102,000. We are growing slowly, but very slowly, from our low, but the we continue to work to build back the programs that were lost. We have, I'll go into that and I won't get ahead of myself. On to slide 12, a snapshot of the population that community colleges serve. Community colleges reflect their community. Although there are some students who leave home to attend a community college, most are community residents. And community colleges serve a very ethnically diverse population. Of note in this particular slide, the Hispanic Latino population of Oregon has grown from about 6.8% to 8.4% in the last 5 years. That's about a 24% increase. The increase at community colleges has gone from 7.7% to 11%, or 42% increase, almost twice as fast as their increase in the total population. We're going to leave community colleges now and go to the federal programs that the department administers. And I'm on slide 13, adult basic skills programs. These are programs that are targeted to improving literacy skills. And this slide provides you with the particulars of what the Department of Education expects the department to be doing. They are delivered across the state. And Oregon is only one of a handful of states that uses its community colleges to deliver this program. The preponderance of states use the K-12 system. A report that was published by the Council on the Advancement of Adult Literacy points to Oregon as being a state model for delivering adult basic education services. And in their case study, they found that the outcomes for students who were taking their basic education courses at a community colleges did better than at other delivery points. There are about 30,000 students a year that are in adult basic skills programs. Slide 14 gives you a picture of, so this is what the first slide is of what we're doing. Number 14 shows you that we aren't getting nearly where we need to. Approximately 21% of adults in the United States and 17% in Oregon have limited literacy capacity. So Oregon has almost 400,000 adults with limited literacy, and many of them live below the poverty line. 32% of adult Oregonians with that limited literacy have less than an eighth grade education. So there's clearly considerable need for literacy skills in the state. Slide 15 is a snapshot of who receives these basic skills services. You'll note that nearly half of the adult basic skills programming goes to English as a second language students. Many of the students that are accessing these programs are employed. So they're doing this at the same time they're working. Almost half Some are unemployed, and some are not in the labor force at all. Slide 16 is then a snapshot of their ages and their ethnicity. Half of all the students that are enrolled in basic education programs are between the age of 25 and 44, and the largest ethnic group is Hispanic Latinos. A companion program to adult basic education is GED, another program that is administered by the department. And on page 17, here is a picture of GED attainment over the last 6 or 7 years. And I want to explain that peak at 13,000. The GED test center did a major update, and I guess they increased the rigor of the GED, and they gave us notice that they were going to do that in 2002. So, and no test that you took in 2001, there are 5 GED tests, none of those tests could roll over into 2002. So on January 1 of 2002, there was a whole new battery of GED tests. We worked very hard, as did the colleges, to ensure that any student that had taken one test prior to 2002 knew that that test would no longer count if they didn't come in and take the other 4, and that is at least our explanation of that tremendous peak. And the test was very hard, and that helps explain the low rating in 2002. And it also, it takes students some period of time to gain the knowledge and then test in all of these areas. Students and adults who use the GED as an equivalent to high school to move on into the workforce or into other post-secondary training. Another program that also provides that segue is the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. It was established in the legislature in 1987, and it is built to emulate the federal Civil Conservation Corps program of the 30s, except this program combines education and conservation. And over the last 15 years, thousands of youth from all across the state have participated. They range in age from 13 to 24, and the OYCC program is funded with the lottery device tax and other state and local funds. Slide 19 is a picture of the Oregon Youth Conservation, a map, I should say, of the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps and where the programs are and some of the other funds. The Oregon Marine Board provides grant resources to the Corps, and you'll see them listed here. I have told the other programs that they really need to spruce up their maps because these are very colorful with the anchor and the acorn. So. Slide 20 is a snapshot of the OYCC participants by age and ethnicity. Again, there are the largest proportion of students in the Conservation Corps are Caucasians, and about 67% are male. I'm going to move now to the workforce development programs. This map shows you the WorkSource Oregon regions and WorkSource Oregon one-stop centers. In 2000, a federal legislation was passed that moved the workforce training programs from being a supply-side program, which meant you trained them and hoped there was a job, to a demand-side program, which is you prepared them for a job you knew was there. And these one-stop centers are a place where either someone who is working or someone who is seeking work can go and get a set of coordinated services to help them get their first, next, or better job. The statewide data collection on WorkSource Oregon says that over 200,000 Oregonians sought jobs and training through the WorkSource Oregon centers. This is an organizational picture. Oregon is one state that, as I say to my federal partners, has resisted the urge to merge many departments into a mega agency just because we all do an aspect of workforce development. And so we operate as a collaborative at the state level as well as at the local level. Rather than moving the deck chairs around, we collaborate on policy and priorities. But this is a picture of the departments that are collaborating on workforce development, as well as another picture of the board, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which does provide advice to the governor and to local boards on priorities. Who do workforce development programs serve? Slide 23. The funding is targeted, even though it is a demand-driven program. The demand, in order to receive these services, you need to be unemployed or a low-income adult, a youth who is at risk of dropping out of school or who has dropped out, or you are dislocated, which means you've been laid off or lost your job through no fault of your own. It does still emphasize skill gain, wage gain, and employment. Slide 24 is a look at the enrollment in these federal workforce programs over the last 4 years. We are seeing a steady decline. Much of that, we are working on if there is an exact single factor for the reduction, but we would say that because the program focuses on employment, that a lot of individuals are finding their own job and they don't need this service, or this. There are many transitional workers who are they're finding their own job, or once they find that job, then they get the training that they need. We also think another factor could be the improving labor market and economy. And we have a reduced number of layoffs across this state. In the last biennium, we had a $12 million authorization for national emergency grants, because the biennium before that, we had received something like $18 million or $15 million of additional federal resources to help serve dislocated workers. This biennium, that request is down to $6 million because of the recovering economy. Also, and I will touch on this later, we currently have, through Governor's Employer Workforce Training Fund initiative, this program receives about $55 million a year. And we're taking approximately $6 million off the top of that, and it doesn't go to serve unemployed workers, it goes to serve employed workers. So they would not show up on these graphs, but in the last 3 years, 24,000 individuals have received training, and we're working on a way to show that on this graph, because we also think that that helps explain the decline. Slide 25 is a picture of the age and ethnicity of the individuals served in what is called Title I-B through the one-stop WorkSource Oregon centers. So that covers the overview of the programs that are administered for this through the department. Slide 26 is a snapshot of our revenues. Hopefully a big enough pie chart so that you can see that 62 and a little bit percent of our budget is community college support fund and debt service. Another 21% is the community college capital construction. And then the balance are the federal programs as well as GED and the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. You ask us to talk a little about changes since the last time, since the 2005 session. So beginning on slide 27, changes, and you will give me some license here because some of these arrows could have easily been straight across rather than up or down. But in 2006-07, the Oregon Opportunity Grant is available for community college students that attend part-time, and we think that's a real up arrow. Unfortunately, fewer part-time students have taken advantage of that. Also, in the 2005 session, community colleges were awarded matching funds for capital construction. Definitely an up arrow. Unfortunately, two colleges have not yet been able to come up with their match. On slide 28, access. Would very much wish that was an up arrow, but it is not. We still are suffering from a decline of the high in 2001-02. We still have a ways to go to return access. The incumbent worker training for businesses, when it started 3 years ago, only about 20% of companies called on their community colleges to do this training. It has steadily increased over the last 2 years, and now 50% of the workforce training, over 50% of the workforce training is done by community colleges. A good investment in something you're already investing in. And absolutely positively up arrow around articulation and alignment. I already talked about the transfer module and much of the work that's been done under Senate Bill 342 to ensure that students get what students need and that they know what will transfer and what won't. Changes in education and workforce development programs, more on the federal side. I've already presented the information that the workforce development system at the federal level did move from a supply side to a demand side, which is a good thing to connect to jobs. Unfortunately, funding has been decreasing, not surprising. It is a discretionary program. Both the workforce development Title I-B funds that support one-stops as well as adult basic skills have seen a decline in resources over the last several years. Slide 30, again at the state level, a little more specific information about the Governor's Employer Workforce Training Fund, that $6 million a year. So right at this stage, we're looking at about $18 million that's been invested. It's been used. More than half of it, about $4 million, goes directly to the local areas, and they work directly with businesses to ensure that the training that needs to happen is what the business needs. The other approximately $2 million is retained at the state and used for capacity building. Two particular areas where capacity building was done was to develop a manufacturing strategy that brought together stakeholders in manufacturing to really lay out what were the next best steps that the state could invest in to increase the manufacturing workforce. And the second was qualified healthcare workers. And so here are a couple of examples of where those resources have been invested. So we have talked about the fact that education matters, education pays. And on page 31, a set of questions that we ask ourselves, how is the department and how are our partners at the local level providing results on this continuum? So these are the five questions. Are we really preparing Oregonians for work, life, and careers? Are more Oregonians ready for post-secondary education? Is post-secondary education affordable? are there more Oregonians that are receiving certificates and degrees? And are we contributing to positive aspects of Oregon's people, communities, and employers? The committee has asked for us to talk about our performance measures, and so we have actually reported these in the context of these questions. So are Oregonians prepared for life, work, and careers? We're looking at two of our key performance measures that were adopted in the last legislative session, the percent of at-risk youth who obtain employment, and that's in up arrow. The percentage of clients who are served by the adult that are part of the adult workforce who obtained employment, and that's an up arrow. Slide 23, are more Oregonians ready for post-secondary education? A key performance measure is the number of high school students enrolled in community college credit programs. We have an up arrow. We have an increase of 7.5% in the number of students that take at least one community college credit program. Also, more than 1,800 high school students are enrolled this year in the expanded options program, which is Senate Bill 300 that was passed in the last legislative session. And overall participation in all kinds of dual enrollment and college credit now programs has increased. Is Oregon post-secondary education more affordable? Well, that's a sideways arrow. Oregon still has the third highest community college tuition among the 15 western states. It could be an up arrow because we were first for about 2 years, and then we were second last year, and now we're down to third. I don't know what those other states are doing, but they can keep it up. Tuition in Oregon at community colleges has moderated. We're no longer raising it anywhere between 15 and 25% a year. But we have received for the third time in a row in the measuring up report an F. And I will qualify that by saying that 48 other states received an F as well. We simply aren't doing enough to help low-income students have access to post-secondary education. But there is an up arrow on this slide, and that is the Oregon Opportunity Grant available for part-time students, as well as the increase in the size of the grant for all students this year. The fourth question, do more Oregonians have certificates and degrees? Again, here's listed in bold the two key performance measures. Both have an up arrow. We have an increase in the number of nursing students who have successfully completed 1- and 2-year programs, a 13% increase over a prior year, and the percentage of students attending community college in one academic year and then transferring to the university system is also up. The last question, is Oregon benefiting? The Oregon Community Colleges recently finished a socioeconomic impact study, and it said that Oregon has a $10.4 billion, our economy is stronger due to the investments of community colleges. And the percentage of incumbent and current workers who are retained in their employment is up, as well as the number of dislocated workers who have lost their job, returning at 80% of their previous wages, is up. And I'd like to finish by emphasizing the pivotal role that we believe the department and its community colleges and workforce partners make in accomplishing the education enterprise outcomes. Community colleges provide a bridge for high school students who are ready to earn college credit, for adults who need literacy skills, for community college students who want to transfer to a 4-year institution, for professional technical students who want and need to gain knowledge and skill to help them be competitive in the labor market. To be that place in the community that brings both personal and economic success to Oregonians. be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Royce Brawley. And I like the way you sort of recreated the conditions of the classroom when the cell phone goes off. That happened. It took me right back to teaching, so appreciated that. So, are there any questions? Senator Devlin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Madam Commissioner, we often discuss workforce issues in this building, and we also discuss particular needs in particular occupational areas. And there's been a number of legislators, including myself and particularly Senator Nelson, who have devoted a lot of time to looking at the issues surrounding nursing shortages. One of the concerns I have is what sort of coordination is there in terms of trying to ensure that as you try to meet the nursing shortage issue, which obviously is a funding issue also, that you are actually ultimately training the people that you need. Obviously, you will need some people that are full RNs, to be honest. But even beyond full RNs, you're going to need RNs with specialized training in specific areas so that you don't get into a scenario where every school of nursing that you have wants to expand. Every community college that doesn't have a school of nursing wants to have a school of nursing. And so that you make the sort of the best investments for what your actual needs are going to be in the long term. And looking at that from a standpoint of the needs of the public, students that are interested in becoming nurses, employers that are interested in employing nurses, what sort of coordination do we really have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that's a very big question. And I'm particularly pleased that representatives from OHSU will follow me so that they can add their perspective to this question. In the 2005 session, a bill was passed, and I'm thinking that the number was Senate Bill 882. But its emphasis was to take a deeper, harder look at healthcare professions across the board, to look deeper into not just who's licensed, but who's working and how and where are they working, so that you could look at the shortages in greater depth. I am aware that the Oregon Employment Department has concluded its first study and has presented it since the 2005 session. An institute called the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute has been founded, and its role is to examine and propose places where investments should be made. So they're going to take the data that comes from this report, as well as other places, and really look at are we making the next best investment in healthcare, given the mobility of healthcare professionals or not, in what communities or not. So I think that I wouldn't say that the Healthcare Institute has nailed it down and has the perfect answer yet, but it is their role, as projected by those of us who helped bring it to fruition, and it includes public and private entities. It's been funded by some of the largest private healthcare systems in the state. It has a diverse board that is made up of all the people who have a vested interest in healthcare program delivery, as well as it's hearing from both public and private entities about where the next best investment is, given good information about where the shortages are and where they will be, not just where they are currently, but where they will be in the near-term future.
Mr. Chairman, I was aware of the Institute's work. I just think that there I will get back with you. I just think that there are some unanswered questions out there in terms of some of that work and in terms of how broad that representation is. And, Mr. Chairman, going away from this and just to make a brief comment, because I do not want, I think the commissioner was asked to comment on something, but I want to put a perspective on the student assistance issue because I know that's going to come up. She was asked to comment on it, on the fact that we expanded student assistance and not all the dollars were spent. To be quite honest, I think Mr. Bender would back me up on this. We tried to set the dollar level so that we would not violate our basic principle, and our basic principle was that no one that applied would be denied.
Mm-hmm.
It was a new expansion. Students had been in the past familiar with the system where if they did not apply early and if they applied late, they did not get anything. It is the first time we have expanded it to part-time students, so no one should be surprised that it was not fully utilized. And they should not be surprised in the future if we modify the system further, if it takes some time for students to become aware of its existence. And to just close, and I just won't take any more time, realize that we expanded it broadly so all students would be eligible. We expanded it to part-time students for the first time, but we did not increase the rate of support that it provided. So when we stayed at 11%, there are still a lot of students that might want to pursue an education that could still not afford to.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions or comments?
Great.
Well, thank you very much. I have one question. Not to put you on the spot, but so tuition has gone up some 70% in the last 5 years for community colleges. Any idea about the cost of textbooks, the percentage increase, the cost of textbooks for students in that five-year period?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring that information back. There may be people behind me who could give you an answer, but I would like to bring it back.
Okay, yeah. Because that's just such an incredible cost for students. It makes things very challenging. I mean, students at PCC who say my textbooks are costing me more than 50% as much as my tuition, if not more, and it's there's something that's a cost driver. So, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you start raising questions like that, I start perking up because it's been my opinion for some time that the decline in the utilization of community colleges is directly related to the increase in tuition cost. Is that your opinion or is it for some other reason?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I would not want to venture a guess. I really would. But textbooks is not in my
opinion. I'm sorry. I wasn't talking about textbooks. I was talking about tuition.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. That one would be... Now you got me totally flustered. Could you repeat the question?
I thought it was very simple, but because you were thinking textbooks and I was thinking tuition, maybe I'd better. One of the things you indicated in the report, and which I think is common knowledge, is that the number of students in the community college system has declined.
Yes.
And it seemed to coincide with the tuition increase. From that, I think many of us have concluded that tuition increase was directly related to the decline in enrollment and therefore indicates an access problem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I would agree with you, and I would add the additional variable of the lack of state support also constricted the course offerings and program offerings that were available at community college. So even if you could afford, you may not be able to get the coursework that you needed. So I think it's multiple reasons, but certainly tuition played a large role.
Well, follow up on that, if I may. And of course, those are not separate issues, are they? The fact that the state's provided less support was a cause of the constriction in classes and the tuition increase. One of the solutions, if I may, Mr. Chair, then, to this access problem is to figure out how to get more support into the community colleges.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I couldn't have said it better myself.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I think that the issue of declining enrollments is one that has piqued people's interest in this process a lot. And I'm wondering, and I don't want you to answer this right now, but I'm hoping that as we get into this budget in more detail, that you have some disaggregated information for us on the fallen enrollment, over what areas of programs it is, what age groups are affected, if different regions of the state are affected in different kinds of ways. Yes, I do agree with Representative Barnhart. I think tuition is a factor, but I think there's also mitigating circumstances around the strengthening of the economy and different kinds of things that have played into it. But I think it would be interesting to us in our discussions about the funding level and the performance measures to take a look at some of the detail around the loss of the students.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. We all learned in community college that correlation does not necessarily infer a causation. Usually there are a multiplicity of factors. So thank you for that question. Very important. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, we learned that in psychology school, too.
Okay. I'm not going to touch that one. Thank you very much, Ms. Spolly. Appreciate it. And next, and I apologize in advance for opening up the kind of can of worms to some of those questions, but I blame myself. Now we're going to have Joseph Robertson. This is what I have listed, and as many of you that are going to and need to come up, please do. Dr. Joseph Robertson, President of Oregon Health and Science University, and Dr. Leslie Halleck, the Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs, and welcome. And my apologies for contributing to the increase in time that that presentation took. So it's all yours.
Chair Galicio, members of the committee, I'm Joe Robertson, recently appointed president of OHSU, and Leslie Halleck, our provost. We're delighted to be here today and have this opportunity to talk to you. I will confess before we start, we are probably guilty of having too many facts and figures. We can't help ourselves. We're from the academic world. That's the academic way. So I'm going to step back and just make a couple comments before we start. And these will be the same comments probably that I will make in a similar fashion to the board that we will meet with this weekend when we hold our first major retreat. And that is, after all is said and done, and after we've looked at all these facts and figures, we hope everyone walks away from here today remembering that first and foremost, OHSU is about health. OHSU is about improving the health and well-being of all Oregonians and Oregonian communities. And it is our intent to partner with everyone in every possible way and leverage the resources of this state to make that happen. That is our core mission. We're a public institution that takes that charge very seriously, and it dates all the way back to the charter that we received in 1887. So I have been at OHSU since 1979. I thought I knew a fair amount about the institution, but each day I learn how much I don't know. But fortunately, Dr. Halleck has been provost for 18 years, and so when I get into trouble, or I will call on her for assistance with those facts and figures. She is also a veteran in the political process where I am not, so I would apologize for any faux pas that I might make, and she will help me in those political waters as well. So I count on her heavily.
No pressure.
Our first slide, we will just march right along without it.
You have a
paper format anyway. And we will start by saying this is a condensation of our mission change, our mission statement, and there is no intent to change it. I think you've all probably read it many times. The institutional components, that really is also, I mean, it's a constant, but in the way of brief review, we are about healing, teaching, discovery, and then, of course, service and outreach. And I think you're also familiar with that. OHSU is a major economic force in the state. We're nearing 12,000 employees and $1.2 billion operating budget. But the economic impact, of course, is much larger than that and leveraged in many ways. And again, not just in Portland, but through all regions of the state. The past year has been a very busy year at OHSU, not only in each of our missionaries, but also in the construction arena. We have had nearly 1 million square feet of space come online, and I am proud to say that we have been able to meet the challenge of filling that space with the program and recruit the new faculty that were necessary to do so.
I'm catching up with them.
Okay. Are we up and... We're up and... I'm already going to sell water for them. I'm committed to meeting the time allotment that I've been given, so I hopefully will allow some time for a questioning. If I'm not going into enough detail, please let me know. We'll be happy to delve into it. Part of the development during that past year, of course, has been on the south waterfront, and we're seeing that really that development was initiated with the pledge to build the Center for Health and Healing. That building is up. I think, as many of you know, it is the largest LEED Platinum building in the world. It has had a major impact, not only in architectural circles, but I think was the catalyst for much of the south waterfront. The wonderful thing about that building is it's not just aesthetically pleasing. It incorporates into every facet of the building the mission of our institution, because it is interdisciplinary. That building has healing, teaching, discovery, and service in it, and therefore isn't just functional. It is also a manifestation of what we stand for. We see the tram is officially opening tomorrow. It's working well. Everyone's enjoying it. It's also, I think, had some positive unintended consequences. We see that the ridership on the streetcar that comes to the tram is twice what was expected, and all of the activities in the building, the activity level is well ahead of the pro formas that had been created. So a lot of excitement on the south waterfront. If we look back not just a year but over the past two decades, we will see a track record of continued growth and emergence of our institution. And you can look in each of those columns and see what, in many respects, in most columns, in most year approaches double-digit growth. The two landmark actions by the Oregon legislature that have had, I think, the greatest impact on OHSU over the past 10 years have been the creation of the public corporation and, of course, the Oregon Opportunity. The OHSU became a public corporation in 1995, and if you will look at the next set of the next bar graph, if you will look, you can see that our growth, relatively speaking, had plateaued, and that it received it was a catalytic change when that was made. Specifically, we wanted to address the use of the state dollars. As you will see, the vast majority of the state dollars go to our educational programs. People frequently speak about the percentage of the OHSU budget that are state dollars. I think that when we do that, there is a risk of the information being not actually portraying an accurate picture, because I would ask you to look at the small circle in the upper right-hand corner with the purple, yellow, and green segments, and you will see that the state funding is a major portion of our educational funding, and there absolutely is no substitute for that. And I know it was in this committee was one of the places where a great deal of work was done during the last session to restore that support, and that is greatly appreciated, and it was absolutely essential to the maintenance of the programs that are so important to provide the health care workers that will be needed by our state. The state funding, as I said, on the next supports our education, training tomorrow's healthcare professionals, our community outreach programs, which include the CDRC, the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, the Area Health Education Center's Office of Rural Health, and of course the Oregon Poison Center. And we like to acknowledge that, of course, the Oregon Opportunity Bonds to expand research capacity and promote technology transfer. It's been phenomenally successful. Those funds have been committed, and the remainder of those in some of the packages that were initially given to recruit the physicians and the scientists will then be fully expended over the next 2 to 3 years. In further diving into further details with regard to the missions, we now have over 3,500 students and trainees, and that really in some ways is also an understatement, because that doesn't include the healthcare professionals across the state that are involved in our various continuing education programs. I mean, if those were included, I would guess that this would be closer to in the one more. We have another zero on there. It might even exceed 10,000, because most of healthcare professionals across the state are often involved in programs that originate or emanate from OHSU. We have four or five schools, depending upon how you count. There are four schools that are solely OHSU, and then, of course, in conjunction with the Oregon State University as our College of Pharmacy. We are proud of the accomplishments and achievements in each of those schools. I think we're proud not only of the accomplishments, but we're proud of the way we've leveraged our state dollars. If you look at either the number of students trained or the number of federal grant dollars obtained per state dollar in each school, we rank at the top, if not the best, of any school in the country in each of these categories. School of Dentistry, we have examples there of, again, how the wonderful pool we have to select from, and the excellent clinical program they have that results in a phenomenally high pass rate and excellent placement. Similar statistics for the School of Medicine, particularly strong in primary care. Of great pride to us is the fact that if you train as a physician in Oregon, either during medical school or during your residency, there's almost a 55% chance that you will eventually practice in this state. All other medical schools across the country would be very envious of that rate. It's often closer to 35%. So when you invest in an Oregon student, you are creating an Oregon physician. The flip side of that is we capture the people that, even those that come here from out of state, we capture them at the same rate, which is absolutely unheard of. So if we train them, we can keep them, is the motto that I would have. School of Nursing ranked very high in both in all of its academic programs, has been very innovative with its distance learning programs, has been very active in OCNI and other efforts to integrate with and cooperate with other institutions, including the community colleges, to try and address the phenomenal shortage of nurses. The most recent addition of our schools is the OGI School of Science and Engineering, and I think in many ways this recent addition epitomizes what OHSU is becoming. We have seen the school undergo a transition where there has been a focus of an engineering discipline now into health, and they have done this in a remarkably short period of time. It's transformed a school that had a lot of activities but wasn't as clearly focused into a constellation of activities that is focused on improving health. We did, I'm going to skip straight to the research awards. We did want to show our research awards because, again, you can see that the Oregon Opportunity really was initiated, although it was legislatively initiated in 2000, in the spring of 2001. The chain of events that eventually allowed the funding to be released occurred through 2002, so it's really in 2003 and subsequent that those funds were expended, and you can see how they have again provided the real catalyst for continued growth. And the Oregon Opportunity and the growth combined with that over the past 10 years are really what have allowed OHSU to emerge into the big league of academic health centers. And again, you may hear us from time to time talk about a specific rank, but I don't think it's important that whether we're 23rd or 25th or 24th. What is important is that we now play in the big leagues, and we've been able to amass the resources that will allow us to do things that you can't do until you obtain a certain critical size. And the Oregon Opportunity allowed us to reach that critical mass. Examples in our slide 22. I should have gone back a slide and acknowledged the fact that the $200 million in public investment was matched by over $300 million private investment through the tremendous work of the foundation, actually exceeding that $300 million goal and raising $360 million. Examples of what have happened are the development of new lab space, targeted recruitment. I've had the opportunity to meet many of these individuals. Besides being brilliant researchers, I think we've been able to recruit people who have a collaborative nature, and I think we will be able to leverage their intellectual capital and the resources because of that. The Oregon Rural Practice Research Network is up and running. I've had the chance to visit several of the sites as I've traveled around the state, and will be this week from tonight or tomorrow night, we'll be having dinner in Madras with a group of the physicians there that are involved in this network. It is unique, effective. It allows all of the citizens in Oregon, or at least a wide cross-section of them, to be involved in those processes that collect data so that we can have evidence-based application in medicine and work to improve the outcomes for all. And we've done a great job, I think, of partnering with other institutions across the state and industry in various collaborative programs. We did show a map with some of those orphan sites on it, and again, you can see the widespread distribution. The CDRC, the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, works through Oregon's Title V office. It also is replete with activity in each arm of our mission. It's has particular acumen and excellence with regard to disability and development, provides tertiary services both in Portland and across the state, and has a surprising number of trainees. I'm not sure that we even know, because it's not a degree-granting program per se, but when I visited it, you see students there from each of the schools, and there is a great demand on, you know, being able to come and be part of the CDRC in each of their schools to have the training that can occur there. And we have the example on the subsequent two slides of the types of outreach programs that are available for children through the CDRC and the geographic distribution of those services. Our area health education centers improve the education and distribution of healthcare professionals in Oregon by educating them that we can't help but use these biological terms in situ, in place, exactly where we are. You know, I think as I travel to rural Oregon and as we try and achieve the right distribution of our healthcare professionals, I think everyone thinks the ideal situation is if everyone could train in their own hometown. Well, that isn't practical and it isn't going to happen, but I think with AHEX, it helps us work toward that goal. AHEX also serve as the core facility for helping us rotate students on various electives and various rotations throughout the state. For instance, our medical school is, if not the only one of a very few schools that actually requires that someone takes a rotation in a primary care rural setting while they're in medical school. We know that helps with the eventual placement and distribution of our trainees. And you have here examples of the incredible numbers of trainees that have been involved. The Office of Rural Health, again, this leverages the state money with federal grants, and it's really there to help rural Oregon maintain essential services. This, time and time again, as I traveled around the state and tried to meet people and become familiar with the needs of the state, I would hear about what's called a critical access hospital. Through that, the funding that's received through Medicare is different. This has absolutely been the difference between survival and non-survival for many of our small rural hospitals, and the Office of Rural Health has helped 15 of those hospitals obtain this designation, and I heard incredible thanks and appreciation for that again throughout the state. We are working very, very diligently to increase the number of students in the pipeline. I think across the nation and across the state, we do not have enough students that are in the health and science pipeline. We have a number of programs that are listed here, and if you noted in the paper, yesterday we had a press conference with OMSI where we announced the joint sponsorship of Body Worlds, which is a major anatomical exhibition that will be coming to OMSI this summer, and OHSU is a co-sponsor, and we will be holding a whole host of educational programs that will be simultaneous with this exhibition at OMSI, and we are hoping that that will help us increase the pipeline and interest of future generation of healthcare providers. Because of this tremendous workforce shortage that we face, we wanted to put in a few slides that were specific to what we see as one of the greatest crises facing our state. And the basic problem is that we are not training enough trainees. We're training, for instance, both across the state and across the region, we're training the same number of physicians that we did in 1985, despite the marked growth in the population and the marked change in the demographics. And I may speak more frequently about the School of Medicine as an example of some of these changes because I was just recently dean of the school and the numbers tend to just easily roll off my tongue. But exactly the same thing can be said for every school, and probably is the situation is even more exacerbated in nursing. But the slide here that is our blue and red slide, some of you may have seen this slide. This is a slide that you would see in the Megatrends book or such. This is the tidal wave of the aging population that is rolling over us, and we are right in the very steep ascent part of that curve. And then if this slide weren't scary enough, we'll go to the next slide, which shows the curve is steep, that when you're 75 as compared to 45, you take 5 to 7 more times the medical resources. So the fastest growing segment of our population is that segment that consumes the most healthcare resources. And we have had a static number of providers that have been trained, and in fact, we see that the workforce is aging at the same rate as the rest of the population. So just when all of us are going to need them, they're going to retire. So we have projections for nursing that, and we'll go on to the green and blue. This is what I would, over the past decade, the distribution of the age of physicians has shifted one decade to the right. Okay. Now, I didn't complete the doomsday scenario slide here because the other slide, other slides that I could have shown show that in Oregon we train only half the number of physicians per capita as compared to the rest of the country. So our saving grace has been that we have been able to recruit and retain so well. But as this shortage worsens, that strategy will no longer be effective. And then we have a similar graph with regard to dentistry, which shows at least that until beyond 2030, there is going to be a marked shortage of dentists. So, and moving on to nursing, the green dotted line in the middle of this graph shows the situation if we had been effective in doubling the number of nurses. The red line at the top is the projected need. The green dotted line is if we had already doubled the number, we would still be losing ground, but we just wouldn't be losing ground as quickly. Now, at the same time, I want to acknowledge, again, the tremendous effort that's been put forth by a very collaborative and large group to try and close that gap. And finally, the distribution, as we mentioned earlier, it's not just a matter of numbers. It is a matter of getting the people to the right locations. We are trying to be as creative there as we can. We mentioned the rotations through AHEC and such, but one of the other things that we do is we actually, in the admissions process, give you points in a certain way for having a rural heritage. We know that if you are from a rural background, you are six times more likely to eventually practice in that background. So it's very important that we recruit a diverse student population if we're going to treat a diverse patient population. And one of those factors that we consider is rural heritage. I'll make a few comments about our regionalization efforts. Again, they are widespread and across all of the schools, but one of the ones that you might hear the most about currently has been our efforts in the School of Medicine and our efforts to work collaboratively with Peace Health and the University of Oregon to place medical students in Eugene. That program has been launched. We have both OHSU and Peace Health have received significant philanthropic contributions that have helped us launch that program. We have clinical students now in the third and fourth year taking rotations in Eugene. We are hopeful in the future that we will be able to put first year students there. We have an MOU that is signed with both those institutions, and we are looking to do the same thing in Corvallis and have an MOU that is pending with those organizations as well. The School of Dentistry, I think, is not only working to preserve and grow its core programs, wants to develop a general practice residency program. These general practice residents, graduates, are very effective in rural communities because they have parts of specialty training in each of the dental specialties, and it results in fewer patients needing to be referred to urban centers. And, of course, we put in there that really the desperate need for a new dental school facility. Senator Devlin, if there we are to the nursing section, and if you have other, we are ready to talk about OCME and the Oregon Collaborative for Nursing Education. So would you like Dr. Halleck to?
I guess that would be the choice of the chairman. But I would believe at this point the chairman only has about 6 or 7 minutes to conclude, so he might want to allow some time for other questions.
The senator is correct.
Okay. I only have 2 slides then. We will leave some time for questions, and I think most of you have heard about the the Oregon Collaborative for Nursing Education, and let me just suffice to say then that we remain as committed as ever to that concept, and I've been enjoyed again getting to know our partners better as I traveled around the state. Finally, let me end on a very positive note. OHSU, as many of you know, was given through a very generous gift by the Snitzer family, 20 acres on the north end of the south waterfront. This is where we hope not to just build a new educational campus, but a new and revolutionary interdisciplinary campus. It will be something that we hope has never happened as an academic health center. Most academic health centers are in an urban area, and 20 acres of land just doesn't magically become available. Our goal is to build a true interdisciplinary campus there. If you look at the quality data, it will all show you that teamwork and communication are the essential components of quality outcome. But yet we train people in silos. We train them in schools. They never mingle, and then they graduate, and we tell them to magically work together. So what we are hoping to do is build a campus that will still have parts that are identifiable with the individual schools, but there will be a great deal of interdisciplinary space and interdisciplinary programs. And things have happened at a rapid enough rate, again, in the philanthropic arena, that we can't begin to say that we've raised the money to build this campus, but I think we have, within the next month or so, we hope to be able to make an announcement that we will be able to initiate the planning of the first building on this campus. And I think once we can initiate the planning of that first building, this campus will become real in the way that the South Waterfront became real once the Center for Health and Healing began to be planned. So again, the goal there is to look toward and build a campus that embodies our ideals. So again, we thank you. I hope we finished in the allotted time, and we welcome your questions.
Dr. Robertson, thank you very much. That was both sobering, the demographic analysis, and then very inspiring. So thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'm sorry for the time constraint. So questions? Senator Starr.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Robertson, thank you for your presentation. Question is relatively simple, I hope. I'd like to know the status of the OGI property and your research facilities in Hillsboro.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, and I will ask our provost if, again, I'm not getting the details correct. The sale has been arranged, and it's closed as of this date, and we are looking at the exact way in which those funds will be expended. A significant portion of those will go toward creating an endowment for the school that should result in a sustainable financial situation for the school that is being combined with a capital fund, with a philanthropic fundraising campaign, so that we think that the school eventually needs an endowment of $60 million. If you look at it on that, we think would help sustain the faculty of the size that is needed. And a significant portion, but not all of the sale, will go toward that goal.
The only thing I would add is that Chair, sorry, Galizo and Senator Starr, this is Leslie Halleck, Provost at OHSU. The sale includes a 7-year lease back of the 44 acres that were sold, with the option, our option, to renew for 2 additional 3-year terms should we need to do so. The idea was to structure that in concert with the development of the Schnitzer campus, but with the occupancy of the Center for Health and Healing, we have already moved the biomedical engineering program to the Center for Health and Healing, but the remainder of the OGI programs are on that campus for the next leaseback of 7 years.
Just a quick follow-up. The research facility that's entrance off of 185th, is there any status change there?
No. The Primate Center property and the VGTI, the Vaccine Gene Therapy Institute, Neurological Science Institute, those are all remaining, and we're not part of this transaction at all.
And they will remain there, I think, for the foreseeable future. There is a parcel of land that the city of Hillsboro is very interested in. And so, I mean, something might happen to a parcel of land, but not the core facilities will not be moved, and I don't think they would in any way be threatened by anything that would be considered.
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Robertson, welcome to, I guess, the first, probably the first hearing at the legislature, maybe not. Leslie, can we go to slide 20? Just one question on the...
Don't watch for a minute.
It's like a Paul Warner PowerPoint presentation. So this slide, and it's around the Oregon opportunity, and it almost lends credence, but tell me I'm probably wrong in how I read it, to some of Joe Courtwright's arguments in terms of state of Oregon. You made perhaps the right decision in terms of the Oregon opportunity, but the wrong investment, or you might have bought the wrong argument. Because if you look at it, in 2003, when the bonds were sold and the dollars were transferred, most of the growth in terms of research awards that occurred, and I think that's the center of Joe's argument, is that if you're hoping for a big expansion in terms of biotechnology, state of Oregon, you perhaps are not as well positioned as you think you might be. There are other areas within that OHSU works on that have great promise, but this perhaps is not the right investment. And when I looked at that slide, I thought, perhaps.
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, there are several factors involved. One of the factors that you see here is knowing that the money was coming. I mean, we knew this for almost 2 years before it arrived, allowed us to make commitments that we would not have otherwise made and build programs and make investments that we would not have been able to make. Also, the fact that about this slide that is, I think, so remarkable that would look very have looked very different without the Oregon Opportunity money is during the last year of this, during 2006, the NIH budget had absolutely become flat. So we continued to have a marked increase in our federal funding at the time when other institutions were absolutely static because of a flat and in absolute real dollars declining NIH budget. So I think there are a lot of factors that play into the timing. I think if you will look again at the trend over time and see how far we've moved relative to other institutions, it's been a phenomenal success.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So does one example come to mind as you look at the growth, and it's phenomenal in terms of, if you look at the overall budget, the employee growth, but just in terms of the Oregon opportunity, does one example of recruitment come to mind of, boy, without this investment, this catalyzed, this recruitment wouldn't have happened, and here we go in terms of maybe commercializing research or...
Okay, let me combine two. I mean, and these were just sort of the first two that popped out of Leslie's mouth. Ironically, there's a synergy in there. I mean, one is our recruitment of the new chief of cardiology, who has... He's a phenomenally successful researcher, but he uses microbubbles to image the vessels in the heart in a non-invasive way. So using ultrasound in these small, tiny air bubbles, you can find out what's happening in the arteries of the heart in ways that otherwise you might have to do an angiogram that's very invasive. Well, Charlie Springer is an image researcher, and I mean he came here, and he's the director of our Advanced Imaging Research Center. Okay. Well, they're working together. I mean, without the Oregon opportunity, we wouldn't have been able to have either, let alone the opportunity for them to come together and begin to collaborate.
And that was impromptu?
That was very impressive.
So that wasn't set up there? Okay. Senator Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I simply wanted to note that's an example of real entrepreneurship on the part of the school. I also wanted to note the program initiatives in the School of Medicine. And as you branch out and move to a regionalized structure, which began in Eugene, for which we're very pleased, but also is going to go to other places, you're going to be educating medical students at much lower cost per student than you've been able to do on the Hill because of utilization of resources from other places that are already in place. And I, when we talked about this before, I told you that I was enormously impressed with that, and I think the committee ought to be as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart. We have done a very careful marginal analysis of each of these of each of our expansions, and have been very careful that we have said we, as committed we are as we are to expanding, we will not do anything that threatens our core budget to the other faculty who have been so committed and stayed in place in difficult economic times. The factor that I didn't mention in their limited amount of times, we mentioned Eugene and we mentioned Corvallis, but through AHEC, I mean, this really is a statewide effort, and we're increasing the number of clinical rotations throughout the state, and we're trying to work with as many of the health systems as possible, again, to leverage our resources and also ultimately to help with the distribution of health care providers.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Devlin, this is going to be the final question.
In our deliberations, which you were not part of, that the provost was part of, the governor, in his recommended budget, had made some pretty severe cuts in OHSU. And after a lot of deliberations, we restored all of the areas relative to education. We restored the areas relative to, I believe, rural health, including AHEC, and the children's related programs. One of the things that we didn't restore, and we made a very conscious decision on that, and there was a direct discussion with OHSU about that, is that you had a modest subsidy in terms of your hospital operations. And it was basically a decision that that subsidy should not continue. Because in a way, some of the burden that you have borne as OHSU should be more equally shared by other institutions in the area that are also non-profit institutions. And I can see that's not in your request or the request that the governor has forwarded. Have you had those discussions with other institutions? And is there some work that is actually some positives coming out of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I think it is very difficult to generalize. We have cooperative discussions underway with some institutions and not with others. I think there has not been a great deal of work done, but there is discussion about some programs that might be more efficient if they are run jointly. So, I mean, there is some effort being made, but probably not as much as many of us would hope. This is an area of grave concern to us. It does relate ultimately to prioritization of the resource, and I don't know, again, I wasn't trying to talk about specific numbers, but where we are, if you look at the state dollars per student, well, for instance, in the School of Medicine, we compare ourselves at $23,500 state dollars to California UCSF at $197,000 and University of Washington at $97,000. And so the decision was made that we had to above and beyond everything else preserve the core.
Well, Dr. Robertson and Dr. Howick, thank you very much on behalf of the committee. Very much appreciate it. Look forward to future discussions. And I now close this informational meeting, and we are adjourned.